Chemical weapons are in the news again following their use against civilians in Syria. Western audiences might most commonly associate chemical weapons with the First World War a century ago. But today's guest shares with us stories from veterans of a more recent conflict, the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. She's Nargis Bajali, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me, my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. This show is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. Stories that shape our understanding, our politics, and our policies. Our guest this week is Dr. Nargis Bajali, an anthropologist and filmmaker currently at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Nargis, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're a researcher, you're an author, you're a filmmaker. How does this skill set shape the work that you do in all of those fields?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the core of all of this is basically what's at the core of your show is storytelling. So figuring out both the stories that matter to the people that I work with and that I research, and also the stories that impact their lives and the ones that they need to deal with. Because I work on the Middle East, so much of what happens are, you know, the stories that the international community builds and the governments within the Middle East build about what's going on.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the specific examples of your own storytelling, but I wonder if you could share with us and with our audience a little bit about, you've spent a lot of work on the issues associated with chemical warfare, but you're an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. How did those two worlds collide?
Well, anthropologists are, especially ones who work on sort of contemporary issues, are interested in stories from the ground up. They're interested in what's going on in people's lives. And for me, the more that I came to know about chemical warfare, the more that I became interested in what happens when the journalists move away from a war scene. What happens to people's lives who have to suffer the long-term consequences of war? And the issue that I was working on were survivors of chemical weapons from a war that had happened in the 1980s. So this was long gone from the headlines. It's a war that many people around the world don't even remember. But yet there were over 100,000 survivors in Iran and many thousands in Iraq who were still suffering from the chemicals that were dropped during that time.
Just for the sake of precision, yeah. You're talking about the Iran-Iraq War.
Exactly.
Dominated the 1980s in that region.
Yes, the Iran-Iraq War, which started in 1980 and lasted until 1988. So it was the longest conventional war of the 20th century. It was the first war since World War I in which chemical weapons were used and trench warfare was used as well. So it was a very closely fought, very bloody battle, and it redefined the relations in the Middle East between all these different countries, and in some ways still continues to do so today. So it's the war, you know, policy-wise had a big effect. But then what I became interested in was what happens to these people who have gone through this war and are living with the consequences today.
So how did you get interested in that story? I mean, looking at your educational background, you have a degree in political science. Then you have a degree in social sciences, anthropology, culture, and media.
Yeah.
So you bring a large skill set here to this. But how did you get interested in that particular story? You could have told many stories from many parts of the world.
Yeah. I started out in political science because I was really interested in politics. And I thought, if you're interested in politics, you're interested in political science. I grew up in a very political family who were part of the leftist movement in Iran before and during the revolution, and then had to leave Iran after the Islamic Republic came to power. So I grew up in this very sort of political environment. But then the more I went into political science, the more I realized that actually what I'm interested in are the way that people make sense of their lives. Rather than telling these stories from the top down, I was more interested in stories from the bottom up. And that's how I slowly went into anthropology. And throughout all of this, I've always been really interested in how people make sense of their lives. And so anthropology is a great sort of discipline for that. And then on top of that, in our world today, the way in which most people tend to consume information and stories today is in a visual format. And I became more and more interested in how you bring about that visual format. And so that's why when I began to do my training in media as well, in addition to academia.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Yeah. How do people make sense of how do they make sense of their lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think people do it in different ways. Within a situation like, for example, Iran, which I've spent most of my time researching, it depends on what sort of strata of the society you ask. But a lot of it, people make sense of their lives both based on what's going on domestically in the country, but also so much of what happens in their lives is tied to international politics and tied to either the understandings or misunderstandings that continue to happen within the region. And so it's very much, I mean, in a sense, I feel like we're beginning to get a sense of that today in this country, where we're really grappling with politics every single day because of the way the elections turned out and everything that's going on. But within a place like Iran, people have been doing that for at least the past 40 years because politics writ large has had such an impact on their lives.
And is it the stories that we tell ourselves?
Part of it, I think in some ways, in a place like Iran after the revolution, the stories people tell themselves matter a lot because that's the way that they can sort of get through the day-to-dayness of being in a place that can be so authoritarian.
So the documentary that we're talking about regarding chemical warfare is called The Skin That Burns. Mm-hmm. We always like to talk craft here, meaning how you got the idea and how you brought it to fruition. Walk us through that, from idea stage to the actual filming and so forth.
So I was really lucky during my graduate career at NYU's anthropology department that part of our education training also included training within what is known as a culture and media program that's tied to New York University's Tisch School of Arts, which is where the film program is based. And so through that program, they gave us so much, not only training, but a lot of support. And so I had this luxury to be able to have a lot of time to sort of think about if I could tell one story, what would it be? And if I could have all the support that I wanted, what would that one story be? And since I had been working on issues of chemical warfare, that's what I decided to work on for this film. It was a story that there were really, no visuals post-war about that, I wanted to, and especially for an English-speaking audience, I wanted to bring that to life again. So as far as craft, I had I knew a lot of the protagonists that were sort of involved in this already in Iran. And this is one of the hardest things when you work in a country like Iran is you have to have enough trust with people so that they trust you with their stories, right?
And that's a theme that we've heard from a lot of storytellers working all over the world.
Is trust.
Yeah.
Building that trust. Well, yeah. So how did you, exactly parachute in, but on the other hand, you kind of did parachute in. How did you build that trust?
So I had been introduced to the physicians who were working on issues of chemical warfare for about 4 years prior to when I began this work on the film. And those physicians slowly began to introduce me to the survivors, both civilians and former soldiers. And so I spent about 4 years on the ground interviewing all of these different people. And one of the things that we realized first is that doctors don't necessarily know what's going to happen, in the long term, because this is really the first time in many, many decades in which physicians are having to deal with this issue of chemical warfare. So they don't exactly know the trajectory of the lives of those who have survived and what it's going to be like. But one thing that they began to notice is about 20-some odd years after exposure, survivors began to develop very complicated forms of cancer and eventually will end up passing away. So what they wanted to do was to be able to document in sort of an oral history format what these survivors have been through. So they were physicians, they were working on sort of the medical aspects, but they asked me to come in as a social scientist and do the oral history. And so I worked on setting up the oral history project about four survivors of chemical warfare. And that's how I came to know a lot of these characters. And then I focused in on one that I wanted to focus on for the film specifically, because he was somebody who, now one of the things, especially for those who were soldiers, they've gone through a lot of PTSD. Even for the civilians, you know, they've had a hard time dealing with this, but the soldiers, because they'd been fighting on the front and then this happened to them, they've gone through a lot of PTSD, and then they cannot, they can usually work for about 5 to 10 years after exposure, and then they have to retire. So there was this one person who became the protagonist of the film, Ahmad Salimi, who the way he dealt with his PTSD was through learning music. Music was his way of sort of calming down, dealing with his issues, and also providing joy for his family. And so I really liked that story, this man who had been through so much and yet would sit down every day. His eyes were almost completely blind, and he sort of taught himself how to play this instrument. And so this is his story.
So again, let's talk about building trust here. You're the stranger from America. I mean, you've got Iranian roots, obviously.
Right.
You show up on whatever day, and here I am, and how did you build that trust with this individual?
So the initial way was through these the physicians that had known these survivors for a long time. They said, okay, please come in. This young lady is here from America. She's a social scientist. She wants to do these interviews. So I would spend, you know, they would come into this one location called the Tehran Peace Museum. It's a peace museum within Iran. And we would do the interview kind of sitting at a table like this. And I would set up a camera and the recorder, and we would do a couple hours of an oral history review, of a history interview. But that was very, very formal. You know, I mean, you can imagine they're just sort of rigid and formal.
I kind of like have to do this.
Right.
I'm glad to do it, but maybe not so glad to do it.
But then, and I knew that was the way it was going to be. Yeah. And so I would do those things sort of as an initial thing. And then I would look for excuses to go and meet them again, and to go and meet them if possible at their homes, or to go and meet them sort of if a few of them were hanging out together someplace. And I would say, oh, I would like to follow up with some questions. And slowly, you know, just kept going back and kept going back. And then after a while, you kind of break the ice. That's sort of, you know, it's just a lot of building these human relationships with one another. And they began to see, too, that I was interested in them as human beings, not interested in solely their story, you know, solely like what they have to say for this project.
You're not coming in, I'm doing the 6 o'clock news,
right.
You know, if it bleeds, it leads type thing.
Right.
So that's a lot, that's a huge time commitment.
Yeah, it takes a long time.
And did the project originally start, were you originally there doing an oral history project, or was it always a documentary?
No, it started out as an oral history project. I didn't even have the idea for a documentary
for a
long time. So that oral history project went on for a few years. And then when I came back in for the documentary, we did that over a series of time in 2011 and 12. And then I went back again and followed up and did more work about a year and a half later. And the more that I was going, you know, the more obviously I was able to get sort of intimate material and to have them let their guard down. Also, it's really difficult to like show up with a camera in front of somebody's face. So, you know, you have to do a lot of work on that.
Just, you know, as a point of reference, you mentioned that the Iran-Iraq war was the first large-scale use of chemical warfare. I mean, we've seen in recent months and in recent years the use of chemical weapons in Syria, but these have been relatively small uses of chemical weapons, if you can characterize them on a scale of volume. I mean, we're talking a really broad use in the Iran-Iraq war.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense of that?
Sure, we're talking, I mean, tons and tons of chemical weapons were dropped. So the first time chemical weapons were dropped in that war was in 1981. Mm-hmm. And then it continued pretty much up until 1988, the very last days of the war. So Saddam Hussein's army was using these chemical weapons, and they were supplied to him from all over the world. And he used them on soldiers, on civilians, mostly Iranian Kurdish civilians, so within the Kurdish areas of Iran, and then began to use them on Kurdish civilians within Iraq as well. So by the first time, you know, since 1981, when he began to use these weapons, the Iranian government was asking the international community to come in and investigate. But because of the bad relations that the Iranian revolution sort of caused around the world, especially with Western governments and the United States, and because a lot of these countries were supporting Iraq, Iran was sort of ignored.
And they turned a blind eye to the use of
those weapons.
Yeah.
So the first time investigations took place by the UN was in 1984. And the UN concluded that, yes, Iraq had been using chemical weapons, but the Security Council ignored the findings. And then again in 1986 and in 87, the same thing happened, and the Security Council ignored it. And it wasn't until after the war that they were like, okay, this happened.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic and beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. I tweet at JM Lutis. As always, I'm alongside my co-host G. Wayne Miller, an author of 14 books and a journalist with the Providence Journal. You can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. Each episode of Story in the Public Square is produced by the talented professionals at Rhode Island PBS. An audio version of the show can be heard four times each weekend on SiriusXM's popular Politics of the United States, the POTUS channel, 124. Our guest this week is Narges Bajoli, who is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University. So we're talking about your documentary, The Skin That Burns. Were there lessons that you hoped the audience would take from seeing the film?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest lesson that I hoped was that war just doesn't disappear when the ceasefires are signed and when the journalists leave the location. That actually, that's when a lot of times the hard work really starts, of a society rebuilding itself, of survivors of not just chemical weapons, but conventional weapons too, have to rebuild their lives. That was sort of my biggest, you know, I wanted people, because it's so easy to forget. And I wanted people to sort of think about that, that here we are telling a story of a man who was exposed to chemical weapons almost 25, 26 years ago, and he's had over 50 surgeries on his eyes, his lungs are collapsing, and that's just one story among many.
You know, it's a terrible and obscene type of weapon, outlawed by the Geneva Convention, but nonetheless used and used recently in Syria. Did you get any insight into the people who ordered these attacks, both in Syria and during Iraq and Iran? What is going through their minds? Surely they know what they're doing. This is not firing a bullet. This is not ordering an airstrike against something. This is something obscene.
Yeah.
Not that the other things aren't, but this takes it to a whole new level.
I mean, to be fair, I did not do research on those who had ordered these attacks, so I can't say for sure. But one of the things about chemical weapons is that it's very effective in creating a certain kind of horror among those who are at the other end of it. So in some ways, it creates this horror that's much deeper than conventional bombs are. Even though conventional bombs kill a lot more people, sort of in a numbers-wise, but chemical weapons, even though they don't kill as many people, they create this horror. And then with both photographs at the time in the 80s and today, I mean, you can see when, you know, the photographs of children are men and children who are just sort of women and children who are, you know, the foam is coming out of their mouth and they're just laying there. That creates a different kind of horror. And I think I would imagine that that would be part of the reason behind it.
And we saw some of those images recently coming out of Syria. How would you assess, you see now sort of the consequences of the use of these weapons. How would you assess the international community's response, both in the 80s when it happened against Iran and more recently with the events in Syria, including the American military response to it?
Okay, so war is about profit, and you know, more than anything, I think, and about power. But profit is at the heart of war making, and these weapons continue to be used because they continue to be produced. And I think until we sort of scholars and journalists and storytellers get to that sort of root cause of it, I think we're going to continue to see this. So yes, people can get angry, and the international community can respond in some ways, but until these weapons continue to be produced in the ways that they are, we will continue to unfortunately see these sorts of things, whether it's in Syria or another conflict down the line.
Where are they produced? Who's making them? I think you're right. There's profit motive here.
Yeah, they're produced all over.
We're an obscene profit motive, by the way.
They're produced all over, this is the hard part. So there's two really difficult things. One is that they're produced all over the world. So in, for example, the chemicals that were used by the Iraqi army in the 1980s, the fuses for the chemical bombs were imported from Spain. West Germany helped build the chemical factories in Fallujah in Iraq. The United States provided some parts. Great Britain provided others. Places like India and Egypt also provided parts for these. So it's it's really sort of an international trade, and you can't really call it illicit because it's happening. The same thing is going on right now today with Syria. Now, the other really difficult thing is that most of these companies that produce these weapons, they will not give out the exact ingredients that are in these chemical bombs because of intellectual property. So this is where it becomes very difficult for the physicians to figure out
to know what they're treating
because they know, for example, it's mustard gas or it's sarin or this or that, but they don't know the exact ingredients that are going into these in order to be able to treat these survivors.
And the companies aren't—they don't have like an FDA like warning label saying the ingredients, you know, 2% sugar and 8% sarin.
So,
I'm sorry to keep harping on this, but the morality of some—I mean, who says, you know, let's go into business and make chemical weapons?
Mm-hmm.
The morality, the psychology—I mean, it's the profit motive, but how horrible!
Yeah,
there's a lot of ways to make money.
Yeah.
We haven't figured that out yet, though.
Well, we're not going to go in this business.
So one of the things that you've mentioned on was that you know, you began with an oral history project in putting this project together. Oral histories are, I'm a historian by training, and they are a often underappreciated tool of capturing individuals' memories and reflections. It's not the same as a documentary record of this is the decision that they made on this day, but in some ways it's much more human. What have you learned from conducting these sorts of interviews that maybe you wouldn't have gotten if you had just spent your time in a dusty archive?
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, you know, I think, so for both social historians and I think anthropologists, what's really important are how did people experience history, or how did people experience what's going on politically? And oral histories are a great way to get to that. I learned that, you know, to do good oral histories, it takes a very long time. Because again, as I was saying earlier, you know, you can sit down and start interviewing someone, but they're going to sort of give you their formulaic answers. But to get to beyond that, you really have to, so they take up a lot of time. You have to really spend a lot of time with people in order to sort of get to, not just to have them recount, okay, on this day is when I was exposed to these weapons, on this day I went to the hospital, on this day I had this surgery, but to get to that other side of, you know, I was scared. I was really scared, and I thought, you know, I was 16 years old when I got exposed to this, and I thought this is the end of my nothing. I won't ever get married. I won't ever have children. And it wasn't until, you know, X, Y, and Z happened that I sort of started to change my perspective on life. So those are the things that it takes many hours and many days into the interviews to get to.
It's almost like a form of therapy. I mean, you're going into someone's innermost thoughts that these people may not have shared with anyone,
right?
And maybe even on some level, not even with themselves. Do you find that to be true here with this horrible situation?
Yeah, after you begin to spend enough time with somebody, you kind of do get to those places when they let their guards down. That's, I think, for me, both as a social scientist and a story, that for me is the gold piece. You know, that's where I'm aiming to get to. Now, you don't always get to that with every interview, but that's sort of what you're hoping for.
Has anyone ever come back to you and said, I wish I hadn't revealed this to you?
No. What ended up happening was that they would first test me, so that they would do these sort of more, you know, formal interviews with me, and then they kept seeing me around, and then they would come and test me and sort of my ideas about, okay, so what do you think about what we're telling you, or what do you think about the politics here, or what do you think about what, you know, the current president of Iran just said about that, and then they would sort of see how I was responding to things, and when they felt that they could trust me. Because I knew that that's what it had to come down to. They had to trust me as a person. Then they began to slowly tell me these other stories.
So I want to, we've got about 3-4 minutes left here, so it always flies too fast. But I want to talk to you about the book that you've got coming out later this year, Iran Reframed, Pro-Regime Media and the Continuation of the Islamic Republic. What's the story you're telling there?
That is based off of the research that I did for my PhD and then have been turning into a book. The story there is about, Iran has a military, it has two militaries, but the main one is called the Revolutionary Guard. And the Revolutionary Guard has a paramilitary force under it called the Basij. And these two forces receive a very large budget for just the purposes of media production. My question sort of overall question in this book is, how does a revolutionary government keep the revolution alive as it becomes the status quo and as generations begin to change? So obviously, in any sort of revolutionary movement, there's that euphoria at the beginning of we're overturning the status quo and we are with the people. But then how do you sustain that forever from one generation to the next? And this has been a question not just in Iran, but in the former Soviet Union and Cuba today, yeah. You know, all sort of all over in China. And what I began to see is that these organizations are trying to do it via media. So they're trying to create certain kinds of stories and certain kinds of images to get younger people to believe in the revolution again.
We're talking about propaganda.
Yeah, you can call it propaganda. Sometimes they call it propaganda themselves, and sometimes they say we're trying to do something different. Yes, but at the end of the day, that's what it is. And so I spent a lot of time with these film producers who belong to these military organizations, and was looking at, you know, what is it that they're trying to do? Because I think the reason it's important to look at in Iran today is because you now have a population in which out of almost 75 million people, 70% are under the age of 35. So it's a very young population that doesn't remember the revolution or the war. So, you know, the Islamic Republic obviously wants to continue as a government. How do they do that?
Are they being effective?
It's very hard to tell. If you were asking me maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I would say not necessarily. But today, I think they're being more effective than they used to be, and that's primarily because of the rise of ISIS and Syria civil war.
And are they using social media the way social media is being used in the West?
Yes, they use social media as an effective tool, but they also use it as an effective tool to surveil. Yeah.
Not that you don't have a lot of things going on your plate, but looking beyond your book, what's next?
So the next project, I actually want to turn my focus back on chemical warfare, but make it a broader study of the region. So look at Iran, Iraq, and Syrian refugees today, and sort of look at the span of a survivor's lifetime from the moment they get exposed to much later.
Well, it's a daunting challenge and an incredible topic, and the stuff you've presented is tremendous, and so we're so grateful for you for being with us today. Narges Barjoli, if you want to learn more about Story in the Public Square, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. I'm Jim Lutis, he's G. Wayne Miller. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Story in the Public Square.